What do scarecrows, strangely colored fish, and appeals to your emotions all have in common? Next on Principles and Policies. Hello, and welcome to today's Principles and Policies program. I'm your host today, Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of an educational organization known as Camp American. Normally, your host is Barry Sheets, the director of the Institute for Principled Policy, but today he had a prior engagement, and probably one of the most important prior engagements, one of the most important appointments you can take, and that was with his family. Nothing important, he just had to spend some time with his family, and as we are both Christian men, I think that's a great thing to do. And since I have the studio in my house, and Barry lives about 120 miles away from me, I decided to do this show on my own so that he could honor his commitment to his family. So, bear with me today as I attempt to stumble my way all by myself through this program. What we're going to be looking at today are a number of methods that are being used to throw you off the scent of an argument. And by that I mean, I opened the show today with a thing about scarecrows, strangely colored fish, and appeals to your emotions. Well, what I really meant was, there are a number of logical fallacies, and some of them have strange names. We have things like, for instance, the straw man fallacy. And the straw man fallacy basically means, it comes from an old medieval ceremony in which someone who was considered a bad guy would be built in effigy from straw. And they'd put clothes on him and they'd dress him up in all the his what would be normally considered his garb. And then they'd set him up on a pole and someone would knock him over. And once they knocked him over, they would set fire to him. And so it was called knocking over and burning a straw man. And what it means in fallacy detection is that you take someone's argument or someone's position, and if you can exaggerate that position wildly and make an argument that carries it out to some kind of really logical absurdity, then what you have done, it's called setting up by changing the argument or making it a really wild-eyed radical thing, and knocked it down by showing the ridiculousness of this exaggerated argument and burning it by completely destroying it. So it's called setting up, knocking down, and burning a straw man. And it's been shortened to just straw man. Now, the other thing I made reference to was funny colored fish. And the funny colored fish, of course, are a red herring. And that comes from an old way that dogs were trained. Bloodhounds are trained to sniff out and find suspects and evidence and all kinds of things. They train them, and they would sprinkle a cheap herring fish on the trail, or they would put the herring fish somewhere near the evidence that they were trying to teach them how to find. And what would happen was the dogs at first would be thrown off by the scent of this fish because, you know, it smelled very powerful. So it would throw them off. What they were training the dogs to do was ignore the scent of this rotting fish. So it became known as a red herring because that's usually what they use, a red herring to throw people off the scent. Now, the appeals to your emotions, there are many, 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 many different kinds of appeals to emotion. There's appeal to pity, appeals to fear. There is what's called the bandwagon appeal, which is supposed to make you feel like, look, everybody's doing it. You need to do it too. There are other appeals to your emotion, like the urgent need. Currently, I'm sitting in Westerville, Ohio, making this, and we have a levy on the ballot. And this is a quote-unquote emergency levy. And when you read the actual ballot, you can go to the Franklin County Board of Elections and see a sample ballot. And when you look at the ballot in gigantic letters, huge letters, it said, this is for the emergency operation of the school. Now, what has happened here is that there's some kind of a state law, and I can't tell it to you. Barry might be able to. I cannot. that says that if the schools supposedly got an emergency levy, and that's what this is all about, they can make an appeal to your emotions by putting this emergency language in the thing, in the ballot issue. And what that actually does is it creates an emotional appeal to you. So you'll look at that and say, oh, this is for an emergency. The fact that the schools will go on without seven more mills really doesn't mean anything as far as the school district is concerned. They want the money. And so therefore they will use any tactic they can to get it. And one of those tactics they'll use is this urgent need emotional appeal. There's another one that's sort of an emotional appeal. It doesn't sound like it, but it is. It's called repetition. Basically, once you make up a fallacy, you can repeat it and 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 repeat it as fact, and suddenly it will take on the gloss of fact when in fact it's completely false. And one of the major proponents of this, not to raise Godwin's law or anything, but Dr. Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister, was a major proponent of this particular methodology of doing logical fallacy. During the Clinton impeachment crisis in the late 90s, the argument was often repeated over and over, day after day, night after night, in the newspaper, on the radio, and on TV, that President Clinton was being persecuted for an illicit affair with a young female employee. How many of you remember it or remember it that way? Well, the fact was that he was being investigated and prosecuted and impeached for committing perjury in a deposition for a lawsuit, which is a crime. So those of you who really fell into the trap of the news media that President Clinton was being persecuted for this affair, no, he was being prosecuted for committing a crime while in office, and the Constitution is very clear. It's a high crimes and misdemeanors standard for impeachment, and the president had committed a high crime. Basically, what the repetition fallacy is to squeeze out any other look at the facts. So you just keep saying it and saying it and saying it, and eventually the person who isn't really paying attention or has other things important on their mind begins to believe it. There's another thing called the transfer fallacy, and this is a biggie. This is an appeal to the idea that you hate one thing, and someone wants you to attach your emotion of that hatred or that extreme dislike to something else, so they connect them. Often, physically attractive people are always used in advertising in hopes. Now, this obviously isn't hatred. This is a different emotion. This is extreme alike or physical attraction. Physically attractive people are often used in advertising in hopes that you will be emotionally swept up by their beauty and stop thinking logically. And gentlemen, this is a problem that we have, I think, more than women, although I could be wrong, but I think that men seem to have this problem. And in fact, if you things like male colognes and shaving creams and always have a beautiful girl in them, and that's so we transfer our attraction for this female into buying a product. If you aren't careful and you don't think about it, you might get caught up in that. In any case, you will remember the product because you remember the pretty girl. Oftentimes, things like images of perfect families are used, or beautiful, perfectly clean houses, sparkling houses, or going the other direction, people being sick because someone didn't use some antibacterial product. Oh no, my children will you know, get sick. Those kinds of things. In politics, it's basically you try to draw a parallel between some figure in history that is not considered someone you would want to be associated with in politics. And bringing up Godwin's law, Hitler usually comes to mind, Mussolini, Stalin, Mao, some other historical figure. Very often, Republicans will attempt to make people look like Jimmy Carter. Democrats may try to make people look like Richard Nixon. Those kinds of things. They'll try to draw those kind of parallels. That's an attempt at transfer fallacy. Another thing would be snob appeal. And the arguer is doing the opposite of the bandwagon appeal. You're being urged to rise above the crowd and join the elite in buying or doing something. You know, become part of the elite. Buy this car. Become one of the elite. Move into this neighborhood. Or it's even been done with chocolate. You'll see advertisements on TV, all kinds of things. All kinds of products lend themselves to this snob appeal. I can think of one right off the top of my head. The Few, the Proud, the Marines. Yes, is the Marine Corps an exclusive group? Yes. Is it an elite group? Well, it can be, but there can also be Marines that are complete reprobates. They do try to screen them out of the armed services, but the fact is that sometimes they sneak through. This is a form of snob appeal, and it really has nothing to do with the actual people who serve in the Marine Corps. They're not snobs, but they are attempting to say, we want you, and we want you to be the best you can be, and we think you're one of the best, so come join the Marines. If they were really doing a true appeal to the snobs, they wouldn't run them on television. They would go personally seek out people they were looking for and recruit only the elite. So keep that in mind. There are appeals to tradition and to high tech, and occasionally the opposite appeal to low tech for those who sort of disdain. It's sort of the opposite of the snob appeal and bandwagon. You get an appeal to high tech and appeal to low tech. And you also get appeals to tradition and appeals to avoiding tradition. So you can imagine what these are about. You know, we've done this for years. There are funeral homes that we've been in business for 75 years, and we've always been there for the people who need it, those kinds of things. But you'll see that wouldn't work very well, for instance, for a skateboard company who sort of goes for kids who are slightly rebellious and those kinds of things. So an appeal to tradition, that would be an appeal against tradition in those kind of bit. We do things differently than anybody else has ever done. Apple does that a lot with their advertising. They talk about how pioneering they are, but they also appeal a little bit to high tech. So you've got a computer company would not do well if it didn't do a little bit of appealing to high tech. Now, for instance, in the old Dell commercials, remember the Gerald kid who always said, dude, you're getting a Dell? That was a little bit of bandwagon mixed up with, believe it or not, they were walking away from high tech. But they were also paying homage to the fact that it was a great computer. It was more of an appeal to the fact that the Dell was a workhorse and would get the job done, and you wouldn't have to replace it in 18 months because it was obsolete. Well, I think we all know. I have a 6-year-old Dell, and it is really obsolete. I still use it, but boy, the technology has marched on. So much for the appeal to high tech. There are any other number of kind of fallacies. For instance, one of the things we're going to look at today is things like equivocation. And you've heard Barry and I talk about equivocation. And part of the reason we're doing this is because we just did 2 days on a fallacy-laden set of articles, or an article written by some Australian quote-unquote bioethicists. And equivocation was used heavily in those and the arguments that they used. What they did was they attempted to create a vagueness and shift definitions of things to make their argument seem more plausible. Now, what they also did in that article, and we're going to go back and look at this very closely, is they engaged in a straw man fallacy and a red herring kind of mixed together. Now, one thing you'll learn about some of these fallacies is that they get used in combination. We talked earlier about sometimes things are anti-appeal to tradition, but sometimes at the same time there'll be an appeal to high tech. So these things get used together because they work well together, and they throw you off the scent best when they work together, and they work together very efficiently. Equivocation is one that we're going to be talking about a lot. We're going to talk a little bit about the part-to-whole fallacy, and we're also going to talk a little bit about the whole-to-part fallacy. And that sounds strange, part-to-whole, whole-to-part. But really, if you think about it, it really makes sense. If you think in terms of baseball for the part-to-whole fallacy, the New York Yankees spent years buying the best baseball players they could get, the best players in the league, and they would pay them all the money they wanted, and they'd bring them onto the team, and it was supposed to create perpetual championships. Well, did it? Here's the problem. Just because you have individual greats on a team does not necessarily mean that team is going to be championship caliber. And the New York Yankees went through a period where they consistently finished third or fourth in their division with the best players in the game. That is the part the whole fallacy. Every year they would be picked to be the champions by the quote-unquote experts who were engaging in the part the whole fallacy. Because they had the best players, they were going to also have the best team. It doesn't work that way. There are, you can have a device with the finest parts available. And if it's poorly designed with these extremely finely built parts, it's not going to work. But when you take it apart, you look at it and you say, these parts are all just beautiful. They are the most well-engineered, well-built parts I've ever seen. What is the problem? And the problem is that the original design of the machine was bad. So, that being said, let's go back and look at its counterpart, the whole-to-part fallacy. Now, this argument assumes that the parts of a thing must have certain characteristics because the thing itself has certain characteristics. Now, for instance, we all know the fact that steel ships float, right? For instance, you go down to the harbor and you take a look at a freighter. It's all made out of steel. And so you might get the impression that, hey, because the fact that a ship floats, then it's a logical conclusion that steel floats. Well, you take off one of those steel girders and throw it into the water and see what happens. It doesn't float. This is part and parcel of the whole to part fallacy. Do all the parts have the same characteristics of the thing as a whole? And the answer is very often, no, it doesn't. Again, we go back to our device. It can be of the finest design in the world, and sometimes when it is the finest design in the world, you can use cheap parts and it still works like a top. That is would be a whole-to-part fallacy to say it's a great design with cheap parts, therefore it won't work, and it works great. So keep that in mind. You will not be presented with this in such mechanical terms, but I've given it to you kind of in mechanical terms because that's what I understand personally. Another important fallacy we're going to look at today is the either-or fallacy. Now, what that is also, it has another name, it's called a false dichotomy. This is a way that, if you remember our interview with Tom DeWeese, he talked about going into a facilitated meeting. And a facilitated meeting is a meeting where basically the outcome is predetermined by the people holding the meeting, and they want you to come to this conclusion that they've come to for you. So what they'll do is they'll give you a series of questions, and they'll make it appear as if there are only two choices. It's either this or that. When in fact, there may be a whole cornucopia of solutions to this problem, but you're not allowed to look at those. Well, one of the ways, you know, Tom talked about, there was a woman named Bev Eakman who has written a book on how to break up a facilitated meeting, because facilitated meetings get people to do things like come to the conclusion that they need to pay more taxes when they went into the meeting knowing full well they couldn't pay more taxes. And when you come out of a meeting and wonder how you got steered into suddenly deciding that you needed to pay more taxes when you went in adamant that you couldn't, you got facilitated. Everybody's been facilitated. If you've ever been involved in any kind of public activity, the fact is you've been facilitated once or twice at least. Now, there are ways to fight this. For instance, you think up in your mind the ways that there are more than one possibility to this question. But you have to be able to recognize this argument up front. For instance, I teach a class and I use a kind of a fictitious, again, it's a sports analogy. We must pass this levy to build the New York Spankies a new lacrosse stadium, or they will leave for the more lucrative Oshkosh, Wisconsin lacrosse market. That would be a quote. Of course, it's silly, but it's a false either or. Note the absurdity of the or option. This is what makes the argument effective. There are other options, like letting the Spankies build their own stadium at their own expense. If any of you have been around here long enough to remember, the Columbus Crew wanted a publicly built stadium, and they wanted it down by where the arena is now. And if you recall, what was going to happen was we were going to the public was going to build both the arena and this stadium. And the threat was that if you don't build us this stadium, we're going to take the crew and leave. Well, Franklin County voters said, fine, pack up, get out. We don't want it. And we also don't want to publicly own the arena, the ice hockey arena. And so what happened? Well, the Columbus crew came in and gee, what do you know? They found the money and they built that nice big stadium down there on just off the Ohio State Fairgrounds, right behind the Ohio Historical Society. So what do you know? Somebody found the money. The either or was build it or we'll move. And the alternative was actually that they built their own stadium. Gee, what a surprise. Someone found the money. But the campaign was false either or. There are all kinds of things, weak analogies. Some of these have strange names. For instance, we're going to talk about one that's very important, and that is called the Seek Hawk Ergo Propter Hawk. It has a nice long Latin name that you will never remember. I remember it because I've studied this subject for years. Seek Hawk Ergo Propter Hawk. And it makes it sound really important. And what it really says is, after this, therefore, because of this. In other words, if one event follows another event, someone will attempt, if it's advantageous to them politically or from an advertising standpoint or for whatever reason, if one event follows another one, they will attempt to link those two events. And it is a gross fallacy. For instance, every time the moon is blue, this you've heard something about once in a blue moon. Well, it's a seek hawk ergo propter hawk fallacy. Often, for instance, TV weathermen will get hate mail because they predicted rain and it rained. Or the people actually believe, in some cases, now I know this sounds strange, but people believe the rain came because the weatherman predicted it. They believe the prediction caused the weather. And if you don't believe me, I would say watch the weather report every once in a while. One of the local guys will say, please don't send me hate mail. Really, people send the weatherman hate mail for, quote unquote, bringing this weather to us. It's interesting that during the early part of Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1981, if you recall, Ronald Reagan took the oath of office in January of 81. During the spring and summer of that year, Reagan was blamed by TV hosts and columnists for the poor performance of the economy, and his budget policies were blamed. Well, here's the bad part of that. The president who takes office in January of 1981, their first budget does not take effect until October of that year. And the reason for that is because the budget year is October 1st to September 30th. The fiscal, or that's called the fiscal year. The calendar year, of course, the president's term starts January 20th. So he's got several months where he's operating on the previous president's old budget. So they blamed Reagan's election for the poor economy. And of course, this was to gain political advantage. Phil Donahue was infamous for this kind of thing. And I actually watched a broadcast where Reagan's budget people embarrassed Phil Donahue, and it really didn't matter to him. He kept asking the same questions over and over and over. Your policies aren't working. Your policies aren't working. And these fellows kept repeating, that's because they're not in effect yet. We're still operating under the old guy's policies. So that can be a major problem. You have to bear that in mind. I think what we're going to do is we're going to look at a specific testimony that was given recently before Congress. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the audio, and then I'm going to break in and I'm going to do an analysis. Now, what this is about, President Obama's recent policy decision to force religious-based organizations to provide health care that includes abortion, contraception, all kinds of issues like that in their insurance plans for their employees, for students that may be at their colleges, those kinds of things. And that is currently under scrutiny. Now, Nancy Pelosi, who is the former Speaker of the House and is now a high-ranking member of the Democratic leadership, decided to run a dog and pony show where she would bring in people to testify about how necessary it is that institutions, especially related to the Catholic Church provide contraceptive coverage in their insurance plans. And as you know, first of all, let's talk about this because, first of all, the federal government has no right to mandate any kind of coverage. That is the bottom line here. And the fact that Congress is holding hearings and actually paying attention to the fact that are we going to require this mandate or are we not means they've also drunk the Kool-Aid on the idea that, yes, it is their responsibility. Well, it isn't their responsibility. It's an individual responsibility to deal with those kinds of issues. And so what we've got here to start with is a giant red herring. And we've also got what's called the fallacy of begging the question. Now, what that means is that you assume the correctness of your position when you go into the debate on the question. In other words, questions are often asked of scientists purporting to represent both sides of the issue. Often both agree that there, for instance, is global warming of human origin, but disagree on the solutions. This will be done in the media all the time. And the idea you're supposed to get is, of course, there's global warming. There wasn't any disagreement among the scientists. Well, that's because those who question global warming simply aren't allowed to have an opinion or are not allowed to express their opinion. The question is loaded, or it's being begged, that there is man-made global warming, period. That is a perfect example. So what we've got here in this case of this hearing before Congress is the question being begged that the federal government has the right to require A, the purchase of health care insurance, and B, they have the right to mandate to organizations that they be required to have certain parts, certain things in those plans that they make available to their employees for free, because that's basically what the Obamacare law does. It requires basically that employers provide that coverage and that it be done in such a way that it costs the employee nothing or a fraction of its actual cost. And I know this because I'm an employer and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do about it. Okay, the person who is going to be testifying is a law student at Georgetown University. And one thing you should know about Georgetown University is it is a Catholic institution. It is a Catholic college. It is run by the Jesuits, and therefore you would think that a Catholic university, would, especially run by the Jesuits, would be very much up to speed with exactly what the Pope wants and what the hierarchy of the Catholic Church has decreed regarding contraception. But don't be fooled. There are clearly people who are agitating that the Catholic Church needs to, quote-unquote, come into the 21st century, which in itself is an appeal to, it's sort of a snob appeal. You guys are back there in the old days with this contraceptive thought. Well, that's not the Catholic Church's position at all. I'm not Roman Catholic, but I have a deep respect for their particular position on contraception and on all forms of birth control. I understand where they're coming from, and we're not going to get into that. What should be noted here is that this person also should be fully aware, since she freely chose to attend a Catholic university, what Catholic policy is regarding birth control.
When I look around my campus, I see the faces of the women affected by this lack of contraceptive coverage. And especially in the last week, I have heard more and more of their stories. On a daily basis, I hear from yet another woman from Georgetown or from another school or who works for a religiously affiliated employer, and they tell me that they have suffered financially, emotionally, and medically because...
Okay, let's talk about this for a second. This is a young woman, Sandra Fluke, and she is a Georgetown law student. Now, you may ask yourself, if your radar is up, why is she doing all this talking about contraception to people from not only her own school, but people from other schools? Why should she be so worked up about contraception and healthcare law? Well, that's going to come out a little later, and we will discuss it, but just keep that question in your mind. Why is this person so worked up and so concerned about contraception, not only at her own school, not just for herself, but for other people as well?
This lack of coverage. And so I'm here today to share their voices. And I want to thank you for allowing them, not me, to be heard.
Okay, don't kid yourself. Again, this ties into what this woman's position is, what her educational opportunities at Georgetown University. She is claiming to be an advocate, and that is a very important part of what we're going to look at as we go along and figure out what her deal is.
Without insurance coverage, contraception, as you know, can cost a woman over $3,000 during law school.
Okay, law school for most people is about 3 years. She's talking about spending $1,000 a year on contraception. All I can say is, wow, talk about the gold standard in contraception. That's about $83 a month, if my math is correct. And I just checked my calculator, and sure enough, it's about $83.33 a month. Folks, birth control of different, there are all kinds of birth control out there, and some of it's expensive and some of it's really cheap. And you're basically being told about this $1,000 a year that it's costing these poor college students who basically are violating Catholic policy anyway, in many cases, because they are having sex outside marriage. Not all of them, some of them are married. And we would encourage them to engage in an act which God has designed for them within the bounds of marriage. But the fact is, why should I be required to subsidize the fact that they want to be engage in that act without taking the chance of becoming pregnant? It's not my responsibility. It's my responsibility to make sure that that can be done in my own household, not in these students' households.
For a lot of students who, like me, are on public interest scholarships.
Right there, ladies and gentlemen, public interest scholarship. Here's what a public interest scholarship is at Georgetown University. People that are on public interest scholarships are training to be community organizers and activists. They plan to do pro bono work. I did a little research into Sandra, what Sandra Fluke does, and actually some of what she does is very commendable. She has done a lot of work against human trafficking and essentially white slavery, what's called white slavery. It has nothing to do with the color of the skin. It's sex trafficking. And she has done a lot of work in her college career to stop that kind of thing, and that is very admirable. However, in this case, what she is doing is attempting to assert herself into the situation between people who are Catholic employees and students of a Catholic university and the policy of the Catholic Church on contraception. And she wants to override the policy of an employer and have the federal government come in and essentially take over that responsibility and mandate coverage that, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, is an offense against God. Keep that in mind. This is not merely not wanting to pay for it. As far as the Catholic Church is concerned, this is an offense and a slap in the face against God.
That's practically an entire summer's salary. 40% of the...
Okay. $3,000 is an entire summer salary. Okay, fine. How much are you willing to pay for your own health care issues? Health care is not the responsibility of an employer. It's not the responsibility of the government. It is the responsibility of the person. Now, we all understand that some people cannot afford to buy. They have special needs. And there are outlets for that. But the fact is that somehow we have perverted the idea that healthcare is not a right, it is a service that we contract for, and that doctors are not employees of the government. They are healthcare practitioners with whom you contract. And what Ms. Fluke is advocating for is that doctors be made be made mandatory employees of the state, in other words, slaves, so that she can get contraception at no cost or a quote-unquote affordable cost for a student. That is the cry here.
Female students at Georgetown Law reported to us that they struggled financially as a result.
Okay, this is an appeal to pity. They struggled financially. Well, look, all students struggle financially, and it's because they usually don't know how to budget, or they have parents who don't have bottomless pockets. Oh, and as this person, Sandra Fluke, is on a scholarship that, frankly, comes from foundation money in almost all respects. It's foundations who are attempting, who have a view of American government and American policy and American society that is vastly different than the prevailing view, than the Christian worldview especially. So what she is doing is taking money from a group who wants to rebuild American society on a secular model, to completely subtract out the religious part of American society, and in fact make it completely into a secular model. And this shows in this testimony. And we just got the appeal to pity. There's more appeals to emotions coming up.
Result of this policy. One told us of how embarrassed and just powerless she felt when she was standing at the pharmacy counter and learned for the first time that contraception was not covered on her insurance, and she had to turn and walk away.
You'll notice she felt powerless. She was embarrassed. Why didn't she just pull out her pocketbook and pay for the contraception? It's not that expensive. I can think of very few contraceptive drugs that cost $83 a month. The fact is, if she wanted to engage in sex and she wanted to do it with a contraceptive, she needed to pay for it out of her own pocket, because she's attending an institution where it's not paid for by insurance. She should have known that.
Because she couldn't afford that prescription. Women like her have no choice but to go without contraception.
Nonsense. Ladies and gentlemen, you can go into a drugstore and buy prophylactics for under a dollar a piece. Or maybe it's right around a dollar a piece. That is very inexpensive contraception. And the amount of money these girls are talking about, that this young woman is talking about, think about it in these terms. $1,000 a year would buy 1,000 condoms a year. There are 365 days in a year. That means that they would have to be engaging in that particular act almost three times a day, about 2.75 times a day, every day of the year, to spend that much money. I'm sorry, this is nonsense. It is equivocation run amok. It's an appeal to pity so far. And we've also had an appeal to fear here, that basically you too are going to find yourself unable to afford your prescriptions.
Just last week, a married female student told me that she had to stop using contraception because she and her husband just couldn't fit it into their budget anymore.
Okay, what are they buying that they can't afford to spend a few dollars on condoms? Seriously, ladies and gentlemen, this argument is so awful, so bad, that it is unbelievable that anybody would buy this, and yet no one was on their toes with their thinking cap on, apparently, because I don't think she was particularly closely questioned on this testimony. I'm afraid I would have had to have asked $3,000 over 3 years, and they had to stop. What? Okay, they couldn't cancel cable. I mean, let's face it. If they're engaging in that act that many times, how do they have time for anything but school and studying? Because they certainly don't need, for instance, cable television, or to buy music CDs, or to buy any number of entertainment. You know, I'm sure they don't need to go to concerts. I'm sure they don't need to go do all these social activities. They don't need to go to the bar. They don't need to do a number of things that college students do. I think this is so obviously designed to throw people off the scent with an appeal to pity, and also with a red herring, that it's self-evident.
Women employed in low-wage jobs without contraceptive coverage face this same choice. A friend of mine, for example, has polycystic ovarian syndrome, and she has to take prescription birth control to stop cysts from growing on her ovaries. Her prescription is technically covered by Georgetown's insurance because it's not intended to prevent pregnancy. Unfortunately, under many religious institutions...
Here we go. Georgetown has already conceded that this woman needs birth control for a medical reason other than contraception. So, what's the problem? Well, the answer is there really isn't a problem. She is attempting to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Insurance plans, it wouldn't be. There would be no exception for other medical needs. And under Senator Blunt's amendment, Senator Rubio's bill, or Representative Fortenberry's bill, there's no requirement that such an exception be made for these medical needs.
Nor should there be. The fact is that if you want drug coverage, you need to pay for it. Now, there are a number of plans out there under the current system. I'm on one that offer large discounts as a tenant of being a member of a group. I'm a member. I'm in an expense sharing group that a Christian-based organization where we basically get needs from people who are have, for instance, all kinds of medical needs, and we send them every month. We get a person, a name on a list that we send them a check. And part and parcel of that is a plan that is a discount drug plan. And my wife and I use that discount all the time. We're happy to get it. But the fact is that we've had to pay for our own drugs for years out of pocket because our insurance plan did not cover it. What this young woman is saying that is that people will forego these drugs. And the fact is that the polycystic ovarian disease really has only a very few things and nothing that is life-threatening. So the fact is that what she wants is free coverage. She wants someone else to pay for the coverage for other people at what amounts to at gunpoint. She wants people to be forced to subsidize other people. I would be happy as a charitable to donate money to help people who can't get that kind of coverage. But the fact is, that's not what people are interested in. They want the government to do it by force. And remember, that's what she's arguing for.
When this exception does exist, these exceptions don't accomplish their well-intended goals, because when you let university administrators or other employers, rather than women and their doctors, dictate whose medical needs are legitimate and whose are not, a woman's health takes a backseat to a bureaucracy focused on policing her body.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, what's the fallacy there? The fact is, she wants to take that determination out of the hands of a local group and put it in the hands of the federal government. In other words, she wants to take it out of a bureaucracy which can take a closer look at the case on a much smaller and much easier to manage basis and put it in the hands of a federal government in Washington, where it's really far removed from everything, and they will make the decision on who gets to police her body. This argument makes no sense whatsoever. We're going to take it out of the hands of somebody local and put it in the hands of somebody in Washington, D.C. Okay, why would she think this is anything resembling like a good argument? I don't know.
For my friend and 20% of the women in her situation, she never got the insurance company to cover her prescription, despite verification of her illness from her doctor. Her claim was denied repeatedly on the assumption that she really wanted birth control to prevent pregnancy. She's gay, so clearly polycystic ovarian syndrome was a much more urgent concern than accidental pregnancy for her.
This right here is a perfect example of the part-to-whole fallacy. In other words, because we can come up with an oddball case, an outlier, if you will, a single case where there may be a miscarriage of the policy regarding birth control for other medical conditions. Therefore, we need to mandate an overall overarching plan where everybody has to be able to get it for whatever reason. Perfect example of the whole to part fallacy. Or I'm sorry, part to whole fallacy. Perfect example. Part to whole here. Because we can find one bad example, therefore everybody else should be forced into the same system. No.
After months of paying over $100 out of pocket, she just couldn't afford her medication anymore, and she had to stop taking it.
Okay, what does that say? The symptoms, as far as she was concerned, the symptoms were not worth $100 a month. Okay, she has now placed a value on the symptoms she was suffering from polycystic ovarian disease. And we know that it is less than $100 a month. Now, personally, I don't think she was paying $100 a month for that medication. She may have been paying $100 a month for several medications. That being said, I can't judge because I don't see her bills. I don't know where she lives. And, you know, I'm not privy to the case. But I will tell you that she has placed a value on it. She's not willing to pay more than $100 a month, $100 a month or more, for her medication to be rid of the symptoms of polycystic ovarian disease.
Without her taking the birth control, a massive cyst the size of a tennis ball had grown on her ovary. She had to have surgery to remove her entire ovary as a result. On the morning I was originally scheduled to give this testimony, she was sitting in a doctor's office trying to cope with the consequences of this medical catastrophe.
An appeal to pity here, ladies and gentlemen. If only Georgetown would have relented and paid for this, then my poor friend wouldn't have had to go through this. It's all the fault of someone else. Now, I agree, she's got a medical problem that is really not her fault. But the fact is that she chose to stop paying for the prescriptions and is now paying the price by having an ovarian cyst the size of a tennis ball. She chose, rather than pay the $100 a month that it would cost, she chose to let it get out of hand. And now the taxpayer, the insured, are going to have to lay out for her to have this surgery because she refused to comply with the tenets of the insurance policy.
Since last year's surgery, she's been experiencing night sweats and weight gain and other symptoms of early menopause as a result of the removal of her ovary. She's 32 years old. As she put it, if my body indeed does enter early menopause, no fertility specialist in the world will be able to help me have my own children. I will have no choice at giving my mother her desperately desired grandbabies. In the media lately, some conservative Catholic organizations have been asking, what did we expect when we enrolled at a Catholic school? We can only...
Exactly. What did you expect when you were enrolled at a Catholic school? You should have expected to get the Catholic rules on contraception in your insurance policy.
The answer that we expected women to be treated equally, to not have our school...
Treated equally. Unfortunately, for these women, they were born as women, and birth control for women is a little more complex than it is for men. Men simply, let's look at it this way. There is only one way to completely make sure that you won't get a sexually transmitted disease or you won't get pregnant, and that is abstention. The fact is that this woman is testifying that A, women have the right to engage in any kind of sexual activity they want to. And since we know that rights come from God and God has forbidden sexual activity outside of marriage, it can't be a right to engage in sexual activity outside of marriage. If you can follow along with that particular logic. Therefore, what she is testifying to is the fact that not only do they have the right to engage in sexual activity very often outside of marriage, but the fact is that you and I have to pay to subsidize them for this coverage to make sure they don't get pregnant. This, ladies and gentlemen, this does not follow.
We'll create untenable burdens that impede our academic success. We expected that our schools would live up to the Jesuit creed of cura personalis, to care for the whole person, by meeting all of our medical needs. We expected...
Medical needs or medical desires. The fact is that this is a voluntary activity. This is not a medical need, except in the person, the one person, remember, whole to part, or part to whole fallacy. Only one of these people shows that it's actually a medical need. One of the examples that she's brought up so far.
That when we told our universities of the problems this policy created for us as students, they would help us. We expected that when 94% of students opposed the policy, the university would respect our choices regarding insurance students pay for completely unsubsidized by the university. We did not expect that women would be told in the national media that we should have gone to school elsewhere. And even if that meant going to a less prestigious university, we refuse to pick between a quality education and our health.
In other words, what they want is the federal government to step in and say to the religious institutions, you have to both provide a quality education and provide free or subsidized drug coverage for acts that are basically forbidden by your religious institution. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a person who essentially does not understand, they don't have a basic understanding of personal responsibility. Because this particular issue is a personal responsibility. It is not a collective responsibility that everyone in society has the duty to pay for the medical coverage for everyone else. No, as a Christian, we have the duty to step in and help people who can't pay for certain life-threatening things by themselves. But we have expanded that into some kind of an idea that people who want to spit in the face of God have the right to expect us to subsidize protecting themselves, and not just protecting themselves from getting pregnant, but also providing the abortion should they become pregnant in spite of the subsidized birth control.
And we resent that in the 21st century, anyone thinks it's acceptable to ask us to make this choice simply because we are women.
Ah, you heard it there. Because we're in the 21st century. 21st century people, you see, are far more advanced than the people from previous centuries. And so we really understand this far better than our ancestors did. No, I don't think we do. This young woman doesn't seem to understand, in fact, anything having to do with personal responsibility. And in fact, that she is making a case here that, again, this is an appeal to high tech, sort of, because after all, this is 21st century. It's an evolutionary view of history that somehow we are more enlightened now in the 21st century than we were in previous centuries. That's not working out so well. Ladies and gentlemen, we really don't understand things better than we did in previous centuries. In previous centuries and in previous times, we understood that healthcare was a service, not a right. Now, if you paid attention at the very end of this little bit of testimony, and this wasn't the whole thing, it was edited, so you should know that there's more to it. And if you really want to find it, you can find most of that stuff is posted on the somewhere on the federal government website. That was taken from a website called CNS News. But if you noticed at the end, the fallacy that most showed itself was the loaded question fallacy. In other words, begging the question. This young woman assumed that her position was the correct one. Now, almost everybody does that at some point or another because we all assume our positions are correct. But she basically attempted to make the point that there really was no counter argument to what that her side was absolutely correct. There were no counter arguments that could possibly come in. And as you heard through my analysis of the whole situation, yeah, I had all kinds of counter arguments. The fact is that her arguments are, in fact, not only poor, they're just simply fallacy laden. And when you hear a testimony or someone at a meeting or read a newspaper article or watch a television show in which no other viewpoint is assumed, you know that there's something wrong, that you're being led astray, you're being led down the primrose path. For instance, on a loaded question or a begging the question situation, you should be asking, there are certain questions you should be asking yourself. And on this one, you should ask the question, is there any other possible position that has been excluded here? Obviously, there has been. She's not being concessionary at all to the fact that there are people who have a different position. She is simply making fun of, with that 21st century comment, was an attempt to belittle people who hold to the Catholic position on contraception. And in fact, we should remember always when we're doing fallacy detection that words mean things. That is particularly evident on cases with the equivocation fallacy. Words have meanings, and when people attempt to come in and use a lot of words to make the meaning of things far more vague, it really doesn't work out very well. We can be fooled, and we need not to be fooled. We need to think clearly on these items. We need to watch for what's called circular reasoning. Circular reasoning is just like what it sounds like. For instance, you'll hear things like the United States is the greatest country in the world. No other country on earth is as great. Many other countries aspire to that greatness but will never achieve it. The reason is that the U.S. has achieved the height of success no one else can ever reach. Do you see the problem with this argument? In essence, the argument says that the U.S. is greatest because the U.S. is the best. And there's really no substance to the argument. It's just basically repeating all these superlatives all the time. And in fact, you heard a little bit of circular reasoning in that argument that came out. She kept repeating over and over and over this circular idea that we need this. We deserve it. We deserve both a great education and subsidized health care. Need, deserve, require even. This was essentially a demand based on nothing other than her personal desire. The argument is really hard to refute because the arguer has no interest in being confused with facts. And in fact, this young woman, Sandra Fluke, would have been adamantly opposed, and in fact would have probably had an emotional reaction to anyone who attempted to refute her with facts. You have to watch for people who are just restating their argument a different way when they're asked to support it. If she had been asked to support her argument, I'm willing to bet, as my mother used to say, dollars to donuts, that she would have either reacted emotionally with anger or would have simply restated her argument in another form that said the same thing. She basically did not want to be confused with facts. And that's also called don't confuse me with facts fallacy. You basically present massive evidence to the contrary, and people just basically say, talk to the hand, I don't want to hear it. That's no way to do debate, ladies and gentlemen, especially on public policy. And that's exactly what we're attempting to do here with this particular item and with a number of items that we mentioned earlier, like levies issues and marriage issues and all kinds of things that we're dealing with, that you're dealing with every day in your lives. You have to learn to put on your thinking cap. Now, I've given you a really quick rundown on logical fallacy today, and I hope that stimulates you to attempt to learn more. And one of the reasons that I do, that I am the executive director of Camp American, and that's www.campamerican.com, one of the reasons is I teach classes in logical fallacy detection. And we teach people how to analyze arguments, and we teach people how to refute bad arguments and oppose people who seem to have everything. And in fact, when you get into their argument, they have nothing. But sometimes it's hard to recognize. If you want your young people, your children and your grandchildren and your nephews and nieces to learn how to do this, please look into sending them to Camp American. In fact, look into coming to Camp American yourself, because we regularly do our best to teach Christian worldview education and teach people how to recognize these fallacies and oppose them. It's absolutely imperative that you learn to think this way. So again, look into www.campamerican.com and look into asking us to teach a class on fallacy detection. In fact, the Institute for Principal Policy can provide speakers that will do that for you. Now, we are out of time, so I'm going to ask you to be in a Bible-believing, God-honoring church tomorrow. Worship at the house of worship of your choice. And to join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.